Kathy. I'm sitting at the bar at Simon's Tavern in Andersonville drinking some glug, and you're listening to Outside the Loop, Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine.
Thank you very much, Kathy. Yes, it is most definitely glug season, and one of the greatest places to get some glug, a fantastic and potent drink, is none other than Simon's in Andersonville. Great spot up on Clark Street. Welcome to Outside the Loop. Yes, this is Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine. I am Mike Steven. This is show number 791. And what we do here on this program is take a look at local issues and topics that don't always get mainstream media attention. You can always say hello to us online on Twitter at Outside the Loop, on Facebook, Instagram. And as I always like to remind everyone, download the podcast of the show. It is free, and if you subscribe, it gets delivered to your device each week. You don't even have to think about it. It will be there for you on Saturday. So there you go. And oh, hey, check out OutsideTheLoopRadio.com for 15 years worth of audio archives. I guess now technically just over 15 years. And WGNRadio.com and the WGNRadio.com app. So a lot to do on the show today. We've got a really great one for you lined up. A couple quick updates on some segments that we aired recently. Back in November on Outside the Loop number 786, I spoke with Melissa Sanchez, who is a reporter for ProPublica, and they really do some great investigative journalism over at ProPublica. And she had a story about Afghan refugees coming to Chicago, specifically Afghan refugee youth. There is a shelter in the Bronzeville neighborhood, and there were some pretty rough conditions in that shelter, and she had the story about that. We're talking about workers that couldn't speak the proper language for these youth, and not enough resources to go around for everyone. So it really was a sad story, but an important story to get out there. Well, as a result of that reporting, Senator Durbin has asked the Department of Health and Human Services Inspector General to investigate this situation of the shelter in Bronzeville. And Senator Tammy Duckworth is calling on the HHS secretary to have the department's Office of Refugee Resettlement improve mental health services at that shelter. So that's really great news and just a great example of how reporting like this can make a difference. Also, take out 25 Oak Park. I talked to Ravi Parakat, who was the founder of this really amazing Facebook group, and he calculated that if everybody in the suburb of Oak Park spent $25 a week, the residents could save all of the restaurants in Oak Park during the pandemic. Well, not only did thousands of people join this Facebook group, but these restaurants are going strong. And Takeout 25 now is a nonprofit, and it was recognized recently as the most innovative pandemic startup at the Governor's Conference on Tourism, which was held at Navy Pier recently. So that is great news that Takeout 25 getting recognized for all of their great work, preserving businesses. And hey, I mean, we get to enjoy the fruits of that in terms of the amazing food from these restaurants that are out there. So just a couple nice follow-ups from some segments that we were airing recently. Today, we've got a great action-packed show for you. Speaking of journalism, we'll talk about the impact of journalism on democracy and a proposal to save journalism and democracy, plus some music. So stay tuned for all of that. Maybe pour yourself some glug. Is it too early? I don't know. When I started Outside the Loop 15 years ago, it was out of a love for telling local stories and a respect for local journalism. A strong press is necessary for fundamentally strong and healthy democracy. And as Robert McChesney argues, it is part of the glue that can hold communities together. Robert McChesney is professor emeritus at University of Illinois at Champaign-Urbana, and he has co-authored a proposal called the Local Journalism Initiative. It's a proposal to protect and extend democracy. Bob McChesney is here with us on Outside the Loop once again. Bob, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks. Glad to be here, Mike.
Nice to be here with you. Again, you and I have talked a few times over the years, but you have the, I don't know if it's the honor or whatever you want to call it, you were the very first guest I had on this show 15 years ago as a podcast, and we were talking about kind of the same thing, preserving democracy and journalism. So I find it, I don't know if it's funny or if it's sad or what it is, but here we are 15 years later, kind of talking about the same thing.
Indeed.
But it's great to have you back here. All right. So look, when we talk about local journalism here, let's just define this. What do you mean when you say local journalism?
News that is produced by locally owned, operated, managed, employed, independent media, newsrooms that cover their communities. That doesn't mean they don't cover state houses, they don't cover national or international politics at all, but they're primarily oriented towards the community they're based in, Chicago, Cook County, what have you.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, like I said, 15 years, here we are talking about kind of the same thing. When it comes to this issue of local journalism and its challenges, have, if you look back here 15, 20 years, I mean, have these challenges changed, or has it been kind of the same thing throughout the decades?
The great change that's taken place started around the great change 25 years ago with the rise of the internet. And that was a challenge to the newspaper industry at that time because they had to switch to digital format. And it was unclear if they'd be able to successfully do that or if anyone could make money doing journalism online as that became dominant. And then I think with the change of the internet in the late 90s to sort of being a ubiquitous surveillance instrument, a vacuum cleaner of information, so it knows everything about everyone, mm-hmm. Combined with social media, what has happened is that the advertising basis of supporting local journalism has disappeared. You know, advertisers didn't want to support newspapers and bankroll local journalism in the past, but they had to reach their target audience. But the internet was able by 2005 or so to offer much less expensive, far more effective advertising for most advertisers. And with that, the business model of commercial journalism for daily newspapers or daily journalism, not just in old media and newsprint, but also online, collapsed. And no one's able to make money doing local journalism as we've traditionally understood it. And that's why it's virtually disappeared around the country.
Is the internet, or I suppose that business model that we have today, is that, as you see it, sort of the biggest threat that we have to local journalism today?
Well, the lack of resources, the non-existence of local journalism, and that's due primarily to the collapse of the business model. Because even journalism is a very profitable industry in the 20th century. Mm-hmm. Largely monopolistic newspapers were just raking in money like they were printing it up. And it was based on having monopoly markets for advertising. And once advertising abandoned journalism, then the bottom came out of the cup eventually. And that's where we are now. Today, we have maybe, you know, just a small fraction of the journalism at the local level we used to have. Anyone in Chicago is well aware of the difference between today and 1995 or 2000 or even 2005 in terms of the size of the newspapers, of the websites, the amount of journalism being done. It's just a small fraction. That's true nationally. In fact, what we have now nationally, Mike, is there's a new term that's been invented called news deserts. Hmm. This refers to counties or cities or communities where there are no paid reporters whatsoever covering that area, who's reporting on it, who people can look to for some information. And if you extend that just to mean there's not a newsroom or there aren't competing newsrooms, then most of the country now is a news desert. And there were no news deserts. That's a foreign concept 20 years ago. Now, if you look at a map of America, they cover most of the country. And in this context, what sort of government can you have? What sort of society can you have when people really don't have any information on the community they live in, any connection to other people? It puts us in the precarious position we find ourselves in today with our society, you know, in the midst of the most severe crisis of my lifetime, easily.
You know, it's I think it's interesting what you talk about. If you even in Chicago, if you look at some of the major papers and you look very closely where these stories are originating from, it's not always from Chicago. Or if you go out maybe to a more rural area or more suburban area and you look at a paper that you pick up locally in your neighborhood and you see where these stories are coming from, it's not, like you say, from that community. It's from elsewhere. And that, I mean, what you're saying here, that is part of this really detrimental effect on democracy that we're seeing here.
Absolutely. People, it's, you know, in one sense, it's just the information you need to be a participant, to govern your own life, not to be governed by someone else, to know what's going on, to have politicians held accountable, and you know who's paying them off and who isn't, so you can actually see what's going on. And in another broader sense, it's also part of the glue of a culture. You know, the local media, news media, were what sort of gave you a sense of what else was going on in the community, who else was around, what else was being done, so you felt part of a community. And increasingly, when that disappears, you know, you move into a city and it's like you're on an island, a raft in the middle of the ocean, floating by other people. You have no connection to them otherwise.
So, you know, I've maintained this for a while, and I think it's still true today that people, you know, really want to know what's going on in their community. And like you say, they want to feel tied into their community. And I think that over the years, there has been this sort of deep social reverence and respect and demand for local reporting. However, I guess the question here is, have we kind of lost our way in that sense? Like, people want that stuff, but are we so conditioned that, okay, I know that this is coming, or maybe I don't know this is coming from outside my community, but maybe I don't care at this point. Maybe I'm conditioned or socialized into understanding this is what I'm getting, and maybe I expect less. Are we setting the bar lower for ourselves here?
I would say the real problem here, if some people say, is that the people have stopped being interested in their communities, so that's why no one's making news for them anymore. And the answer is that the reason why we don't have local news isn't because public demand or popular demand ended for it. It's rather the advertisers jumped ship, so there wasn't anyone bankrolling it. And once that happened, the reporters lost their jobs, news media closed down or totally downsized. And, you know, this is the dilemma we face. And so, do people want local journalism? Absolutely. But they're not going to get it through the market. The Wall Street, the investment communities jump ship. They've given up on journalism. They don't think it'll work, especially at the local level, but really at any level. Broad popular journalism, the foundation of our society in the First Amendment, is gone. It's not commercially viable anymore. So then the question is, if the market says you can't have journalism anymore because people can't get rich doing local journalism, does that mean you just don't have journalism? Do you just fold up your tent and no longer have a democratic society? Or do you do something about it? And this is where looking at the founders of this country is so important. This country was started by people who said the first thing we need is a press system. Jefferson famously said, I'd rather have a society with no government and a press system than a society with a government and no newspapers. He said, you know, because if you have a government with no newspapers or no press system, no journalism, it'll be a tyranny sooner or later, probably sooner. So you've got to, if you have serious about self-government where people could participate in controlling their community, their own lives, and be governors of themselves, not just be governed by someone else, you've got to have a press. And for that reason, the framers, no one was making money doing journalism then, instituted massive public subsidies. Basically, they distributed, for the first 100 years of American history, the U.S. Post Office main job was distributing every newspaper in the country at well below cost, many of them for free, to encourage newspapers to start and to be distributed and to have everyone involved in them, because newspapers are the way people connected socially and politically to make this one country.
I think that's amazing. And you do write about that, how the post office, and I'm willing to bet many of us don't know that, were in the business, the post office was in the business of distributing newspapers because they wanted these papers to start. And again, you know, that idea is great, but when you sort of combine it with the deal that we made with the business model here, and how, as you say, advertisers are jumping ship, and that's a problem. Look, I mean, look at the Chicago Tribune. Look here in Chicago, right? We've seen the Chicago Tribune essentially become a shell of what it was. There are still good people that work there, but, you know, I think here in Chicago, we're suffering because of what you're talking about.
It's happening everywhere in the country. I mean, Chicago actually looks better than a lot of places because it's a major city, but it's a nightmare everywhere. And look at the COVID crisis now. We have a substantial part of our population an absurdly high percentage, about 20, 25, 30% that doesn't believe in vaccines or thinks they're some sort of threat to them. Well, and they're getting their information from where? Joe Rogan? I don't know where, but they're, right. they're getting it from some crazy place. Mm-hmm. You know, this would have been impossible 40 or 50 years ago when the polio vaccine came along, or smallpox. People got it. They understood science. So they had local journalists and media who were explaining this to them. And if there was some crackpot saying no vaccines are crazy, the local media would have investigated it and said, well, let's look at the record. And there would have been some evidence there. And this is all gone now. And so we have situations where conspiracy theories like this QAnon stuff can blossom without a scintilla of evidence, where they should have been snuffed out long ago.
So you have now made this proposal. You've co-created this proposal, this local journalism initiative. I think this is fascinating and important to talk about and dive into. And so let's think about this here. So look, you're saying here, and you write this along with John Nichols, you say, this is a quote, "We need the funding to support independent, competitive, professional local news media. That money must come from the government," end quote. So, I don't know, maybe today we hear, oh no, the government's going to be involved, sirens and bells. But, Bob, if you could, just briefly explain, just broadly speaking, what this local journalism initiative is as you see it.
Well, again, it starts, like you just said, with the premise that popular journalism for the broad mass of people in this country is a public good. It's something society needs, but the market can't produce in sufficient quality or quantity, much like public education. If we had a purely market-driven public education, 80% of the society would be illiterate because people wouldn't be able to afford the cost of school. Mm-hmm. So it's the same principle. And advertising hid the public good nature of journalism for the last 100 years because the advertisers bankrolled it. But now that they're jumping ship, we're back to where we were at the time of the founders. No advertising. How are we going to have this? And like the founders did it with the post office, we've got to come up with a way to subsidize journalism so we actually have it. And remember that journalism, the press, is not just some ephemeral thing. It is a crucial institution. It's a political part of our system. Our system can't work without it. It is the fourth estate. And what the local journalism initiative says, okay, the public has to pay for it, but we don't want the government to control who gets the money. So we set a budget, and we put it at roughly $100 per person. And every county will get a budget. And every 3 years, people in that county will vote for who they want, which nonprofit media, locally based, that meets the criteria that are laid out, will get some of this funding to pay for them to do their journalism. And it's their choice. And whoever qualifies for the ballot, you can vote for. And whoever you get, the amount of money you get is by how many votes you get, what percentage of the vote you get. And then it's divvied up. And the way it's structured, at least four in every county, at the bare minimum, there will be four really well-funded newsrooms covering that county. And in a county like Cook County, it'd be more like 10 or 12 or 15, probably, if not more. But I'll go into the details. So it creates all these newsrooms. And then the question is, well, once they get their money and they're nonprofit and they're covering the community, what are the conditions? Well, anything they produce has to be put online immediately. It's available to anyone for free. So we're paying them up front to do the work, and then they've got to produce content that goes to everyone for free. No paywalls, no secret codes or passwords.
Right.
You paid for it as a taxpayer. We're living in script. You get access to it, and you've got enough money producing it so you can see it. So that's the core principle. And then there's elections every 3 years, so you can vote someone up and find someone new. There's competition this way for ideas and for money. There's no government censorship. The government doesn't monitor the content to say it's true or false or good or bad. That's not their job. And hopefully the people of any community would monitor the content and select media that would be good because it's in their interest.
Right.
It's like a democracy. It's who you want. And if they screwed up, that's on them. But at least it's on them, not on someone else.
Yeah, I think this proposal is, you know, we talk about democracy and it really is tied into that. So basically everyone in the county, wherever you live, would get three votes. You would get to vote for three entities.
Three different media.
Right.
Because the idea is we want competitive media. No one wants to live in a place where there's only one newsroom covering you. So you get three votes. So you can pick a diet. What are the three newsrooms you think would really mesh well for me?
Mm-hmm. And so the people get to choose, and you know, there are some criteria here in terms of the, like you were saying, that the outlet must be producing content 5 days a week, and it can't be, you know, someone's blog in their basement. But we would get to choose which of these outlets would get funding, and then anything that these outlets would produce, these journalism outlets, would be free. So no paywalls, we would get to consume that, and then there would be this election where we could either re-up the funding or take away that funding. And I was going to ask you, you know, we've seen so much with partisan media outlets, sort of the extremes. So if people, you know, don't like it, we don't have to fund it. But there's also the possibility here that we could get it wrong. But that's democracy, right? So hopefully we would somehow correct ourselves. But really, this is in the hands of the people.
Exactly. And it also gets the con artist crowd out of there, because, you know, you have to be fully nonprofit. So you can't be guys making money, you know, under the table, being paid off or anything. You've got to meet the nonprofit criteria, which are pretty rigorous, thanks to the IRS. And that'll keep the crooks out of there.
And again, you know, we talk about the role of government, and today that seems to be, for some, just the ultimate bad word, the G word, right, when we have government involved. But, you know, I think part of what you're saying here is government could have a positive role to play. They're not censoring, at least in this proposal. You're saying there would be no government censorship, but government could help allocate these funds and move our democracy forward. And hey, I mean, look, government should be doing something, right? This could be an opportunity for good.
Well, you know, the U.S. government is active in creating the press system throughout our history. And I was raised, and I suspect you were, most of our listeners were, to think any government involvement with the press was going to be like an open invitation to dictatorship and propaganda, yeah, in 1984.
Right.
But if you look at the most democratic nations in the world today, by all criteria, The Economist magazine ranks them annually in this democracy index. The countries at the very top is the most democratic countries in the world, the freest, fairest, most functional democracies, are the countries that spend the most on journalism. Their governments spend the most on journalism and public media. You know, those are Norway, Germany, Japan, Scandinavian countries, Canada. In the United States, in these listings of democratic countries, we aren't even at the top anymore. We're down like in the 20s. You know, we're with countries like Hungary and Poland, you know, but we're some pretty unsavory dudes,
right,
to be next to in terms of your politics. And, you know, if you look at these countries, you know, so clearly the most democratic countries have figured out a way that in a democracy, you can use this money to actually promote democracy. You know, if a dictatorship spends money in media, it's going to be propaganda. But in a democracy, it can be structured in such a way as to promote democratic values. And that's clearly what happened in this country for the first 100 years. And it's what happened, what's happening now in all the great democracies of the world, of which, regrettably, we're no longer one.
This local journalism initiative, another reason why I think it's really, really worth thinking about, is because we're talking about funding journalism and those outlets in, you know, a very hyper-local, to use a sort of buzzword, a hyper-local situation. So meaning communities of color, traditionally marginalized communities, could vote to have journalism that really represents who they are and tells the stories that are important to those communities.
That's such an important point. In Cook County, for example, we have a very sizable communities of color, African American, Latinos. In those communities, you know, they will have, with these votes, they will have access to resources to guarantee that there will be media of, by, and for communities of color in that county. And, you know, it will open up the sort of discourse level, the journalism, the participation, in ways unimaginable in American history, all across the country. It's, you know, we've got to remember that in the eyes of democratic theory and sort of the founders of this country, media are really political institutions. That doesn't mean they have to be hyper-partisan, but they're all about getting people to be engaged in the social world and in politics. And this will invigorate people who are sluggish and lethargic. They've given up an opportunity to really get involved in the world that traditionally has been restricted to people in the upper class. It's going to extend it to everyone.
Before I let you go, Bob, where do we go from here? I mean, you have co-authored this proposal, this local journalism initiative, and it sounds, I mean, I'm excited talking about it, but I geek out about this stuff. And I think when people understand what this is about, this would sound very practical. But how do we get there? What are some of the next steps going forward?
Well, right now, we just launched the campaign. We just want people to read about it, understand it, see the problem. They don't even have to like our proposal, but just understand that we've got to do something, and we have to take it really seriously right away. And so what we're doing is getting the word out. Next year, we will try to go back to our friends on Capitol Hill, of which we've got some friends up there, and talk about the issue and hopefully get hearings and ideally legislation drafted, and then do a much broader campaign all across the country with people to get enthusiastic support for it. So far, you know, traditionally you would say this is a super long shot. I mean, it's like a shot in the dark. But the crisis we're facing in this country right now, where we really have a lot of very smart people for the first time in my lifetime, talking about how we could lose democracy altogether in this country by the end of the decade. We'll lose the rule of law. We will lose our freedoms. We will lose an accountable government. You know, when you're talking in terms like this, these are special times. This isn't like 1953 and mom just got an Oldsmobile. This is like, you know, we're talking about existential survival. And we better start talking about real solutions and stop playing around and thinking just put our head in the sand and everything will work out. We've tried that for the last 10 years, and where has it gotten us? Well, look where we are today.
Yeah. Well, this is a proposal for sure worth thinking about, worth talking about. Again, it's called the Local Journalism Initiative. It's co-authored by Robert McChesney, Professor Emeritus at the University of Illinois, Champaign-Urbana. We will link up to this proposal through all of our social media outlets and all of our many tentacles of Outside the Loop. Bob, I guess before I let you go, I got to say again, you were the first guest on this show 15 years ago, and I was a fan of yours when I was in college at Loyola in Chicago, reading you and John Nichols, and John Nichols is on Bill Moyers, and here's what McChesney wrote, and sort of, you know, geeking out about that stuff, about democracy, which I hope we can all geek out about democracy. It sounds like we might need to. So thank you for all of your hard work and for your time talking to us today.
My great pleasure to be here.
Us today here on Outside the Loop is local singer-songwriter Peter Jolie. Check out his music at peterjolie.bandcamp.com. Peter, welcome to Outside the Loop.
Thanks, Mike. I'm really happy to be here. Happy to be here on a Saturday morning.
Well, it's great to have you here today. And I said singer-songwriter. I feel like sometimes people really embrace that term singer-songwriter. Other times people are like, oh, don't call me that. But is that right for you? Do you embrace the singer-songwriter?
Yeah, I do. I think that's the perfect description for what I do. I came to town in 93 from Buffalo, New York, and my inspirations have always been singer-songwriters, Joan Armatrading, people like James Taylor, of course, Jackson Browne, all of those folks that people like who make music like I do gravitate towards at a young age. And I play in bands, but I also enjoy doing the really stripped down solo shows, the solo stuff, the duo stuff. I wear the singer-songwriter moniker as a badge of honor.
That's good. Well, you know, it's funny because if you've ever played, if anyone out there has ever played in a band, you know, the more people you have in the band, it's easier to sort of like hide behind it. And maybe if you don't have a good show, it's like, well, that's okay. I've got like four other people in here in this band that can make up for it. Or maybe people didn't really notice me. When it's just you, when it's the singer-songwriter situation, and I know you do a residency at Lizard's Liquid Lounge where usually it's just you. I mean, it's just you. If you have a bad night, everyone's going to know.
Yep, that's for sure. And you know what? I've become real comfortable playing solo. I love playing with the guys and women in my band. But as you say, it's the singer-songwriter part of it always has been primary to my music. Even when I'm playing with other musicians, my core band are some of the best players in town. John Williams plays guitar with me. Josh Pyatt plays upright bass with me, and Rachel Drew sings sings with me as well and with the band. But the focus really is about the songs. And so those are never lost. How you you exampled getting lost in a band like that. But those are never lost. Those are always right up front. And those are our, that's what we're trying to showcase at the songs.
So you mentioned a couple of your influences there, but, you know, just thinking about your influences and how you sort of got to this acoustic style, because not everyone goes that direction. Sometimes it's, you know, like, let's plug in and let's get loud. And you do, you know, when you play with other musicians, I know that there are some electric instruments in there, but this overall acoustic sound, how did that evolve for you?
I've always been, that's what's always touched me, deeply is a well-tuned acoustic guitar, sound. That's the first thing I can ever remember hearing on a record and thinking, wow, I want to make that sound.
Which is, this acoustic sound is featured on your new record that is called Easy Has Never Been the Way. Again, check out peterjolie.bandcamp.com for this new record. And you have other musicians on this record, but the acoustic sound is very much front and center. Tell us about this new album.
Oh, this is something I'm really proud of. This is the second solo release that I've done. This was produced by John Williams, as was my first one in 2016. And pretty much a lot of the same folks on both records. Everybody was excited to play the songs. And to me, that's... I'm just so proud of that, and to be you know, to be playing with these great guys. These are some of the best players in the city.
So you've got some gigs coming up here. The biggest one, I suppose you could say, January 22nd. So after the holidays, in the new year, January 22nd at the Fitzgerald's Sidebar in Berwyn, right on, yes, Roosevelt Road, one of the greatest venues in the area, of course. That's January 22nd. That'll be great.
I'm super excited because for those folks who've been out to the Sidebar pre-COVID, and it was the they were kind of a separated area from another banquet room. What the new owner, Will Duncan, brilliantly decided to do with the downtime was to kind of knock that wall down, make it a big room in the Sidebar there. And so it's the stage has been moved to the other end of the room, and it's all opened up. And I've done gigs there before as the original Sidebar.
Yeah.
But this is the new and improved Sidebar. So me and the band, we're super excited, and that will be a band show.
So that's January 22nd at Fitzgerald's, the Sidebar, the new and improved Sidebar. I have to get in there. I've not been into the new Sidebar, but
this will be my first gig there with the band. And, I'm very excited as well, too, in the new space. I'm very excited to play there and hear how it sounds in the new room. And it's going to be a fun night. It's going to be a great night.
That will be very cool. Well, peterjolie.bandcamp.com is where we can go in the meantime for more music from Peter Jolie.
Yeah, and also, if I can just say also,
sure,
my Facebook page is probably where you're going to get the most informative information about upcoming shows and things like that. And what I'm doing, you know, like yesterday, is called Peter Jolie Music. It's a public page on Facebook, Peter Jolie Music.
All right, we will link up to all that. But Peter Jolie, local singer-songwriter, who's got a lot coming down the pipeline here. New album called Easy Has Never Been the Way. You sound great. Everyone on the record sounds great. Peter, thank you so much for talking to us today.
Oh, Mike, I'm so pleased to be here. Thank you for interviewing me.
You, with your old-fashioned ways and your old-fashioned songs that your radio plays. Just one day a week, if your reception is strong and the weather is clear. And you, in a 10-gallon hat, in a seat on a train that is headed uptown.
And that'll do it. Outside the Loop, show number 791 is all done. Thank you so much for listening to the show this week. I really do appreciate it. Thanks to Bob Ferguson for being our engineer this week. Have a fantastic week, and I'll talk to you again next time right here on Outside the Loop on 720 WGN.